is Mission to Israel, a broadcast ministry featuring author, teacher, and evangelist Ted R. Weiland. It's our prayer here at Mission to Israel that our time together will inspire you, give you insight into current events, and reveal your place in God's plan. Our address is Mission to Israel, Post Office Box 248, Scottsbluff, Nebraska 69363. Or contact us via the web at www.missiontoisrael.org. And now, here's Ted Weiland.
I'd like you to take your Bibles this morning and turn to 1 Samuel, 1 Samuel chapter 1. The first book of Samuel doesn't actually begin with Samuel. Just as each of our stories, our life stories, don't begin with ourselves, but instead with our progenitors. Who we are is a combination, an accumulation, if you will, of all of our forefathers, all of our people, all the way back to Adam. We are the accumulation of all of our progenitors, our line all the way back to Adam. And who our children are will be the same. With two additional factors, of course, added into the mix, and that's their mother and father. And they will be the same to their children as well. Their children will be an accumulation of all of their ancestors, those two lines, and their trip back to Adam. Of course, as Christians, we are wonderfully blessed with the opportunity to actually even alter some of the results of those genetics, if you will, from those lines through Christ, that he gives us the opportunity to take what wasn't necessarily or what was handed down to us through example or otherwise, to be able to be cycle breakers in those areas where it's bad. And thus we have the opportunity to alter that line and change it from that point on. I don't know. I can't look back in my line and see that there were any Christians previous to this, my generation. There may have been that I'm certainly unaware of. I suspect that there was somewhere along the line and there was a departure along the line, probably, or maybe there never was. But this generation and in my children's generation have that opportunity to alter, to be cycle breakers in the areas that even their Christian parents didn't do everything perfectly, and to make it even better for the next generation. Nevertheless, our life story does not begin with just us. That's not our life story. Our life story begins with our parents. And neither did Samuel's life story or his story begin with him, but with his parents, and in particular, as Yahweh chose to relate it to us, with his mother. 1 Samuel chapter 1, beginning with verse 1. We're going to read a good part of this story, of his story, as it began with his mother. 1 Samuel chapter 1, verse 1. Now there was a certain man of Ramathah Zophim of Mount Ephraim, and his name was Elkanah, the son of Jehoram, the son of Elihu, the son of Tohu, and the son of Zuf, an Ephrathite. Man, at least Samuel got a decent name out of it. He changed the cycle there. And he had two wives. The name of the one was Hannah, and the name of the other Peninnah. And Peninnah had children, but Hannah had no children. And this man went up out of his city yearly to worship and to sacrifice unto Yahweh of hosts in Shiloh, and the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, the priests of Yahweh, were there. Now that's not the original Phinehas that we know in Numbers 25, but another Phinehas. And when the time was that Elkanah offered, he gave to Peninnah his wife and to all her sons and her daughters portions. But unto Hannah he gave a worthy portion, or some versions say a double portion, for he loved Hannah, but Yahweh had shut up her womb. And her adversary also provoked her sore, for to make her fret, because Yahweh had shut up her womb. And as he did so year by year, when she went up to the house of Yahweh, so she provoked her. Therefore she wept and did not eat. Then said Elkanah, her husband, to her, Hannah, why weepest thou, and why eatest thou not, and why is thy heart grieved? Am I not better to thee than 10 sons? So Hannah rose up after they had eaten in Shiloh, and after they had drunk. And now Eli the priest sat upon the seat by a post of the temple of Yahweh. And she was in bitterness of soul, and prayed unto Yahweh, and wept sore. And she vowed a vow, and said, O Yahweh of hosts, if thou wilt indeed look upon the affliction of thy handmaid, and remember me, and not forget thy handmaid, but will give unto thy handmaid a man-child, a son, then I will give him unto Yahweh all the days of his life. And there shall no razor come upon his head. So she was setting him apart, much like Samson, to be a Nazarite from his birth. It would appear anyway, that would appear to be the case. Verse 12, and it came to pass, as she continued praying before Yahweh, that Eli marked her mouth. Now Hannah, she spake in her heart, only her lips moved, but her voice was not heard, and therefore Eli thought she had been drunken, or was drunk. And Eli said unto her, How long wilt thou be drunken? Put away thy wine from thee. And Hannah answered and said, No, my lord, I am a woman of sorrowful spirit. I have drunk neither wine nor strong drink, but have poured out my soul before Yahweh. Count not thy handmaid for a daughter of Belial, for out of the abundance of my complaint and grief have I spoken hitherto. Then Eli answered and said, Go in peace, and the God of Israel grant thee thy petition that thou hast asked of him. And she said, Let thy handmaid find grace in thy sight. So the woman went her way and did eat, and her countenance was no more sad. She took faith and strength in the fact of what Eli had said. Verse 19, And they arose up in the morning early and worshipped before Yahweh, and returned and came to their house in Ramah. And Elkanah knew Hannah his wife, and Yahweh remembered her. Verse 20, Wherefore it came to pass, when the time was come about after Hannah had conceived, that she bare a son, and called his name Samuel, or Samuel. Now let me pause here briefly, because we're going to read some more of this, but let me pause here briefly. How many times, thinking about this story, thinking about this commitment, thinking about the vow that Hannah now has made before her God, and with her God, how many times has someone in the time of grief or pain or sorrow or trials or tribulation made a vow, bargained with Yahweh, you know, get me out of this, God, and I'll do so and so. But after Yahweh has fulfilled his side of the bargain, his side of the agreement, the person, how many times has it been that the person conveniently has forgotten their part? Or his part, I should say, of his covenant with Yahweh. In Ecclesiastes, Solomon warns us against such folly, to put it lightly, to make a covenant with Yahweh, and not fulfill your end of the bargain is perhaps better described as stupidity or even lunacy. I mean, think about, you know, such a bargain. And for God to fulfill his side and for you not to fulfill your side, what lunacy for anyone to think that they can get away with such with God. Turn to Ecclesiastes, in fact. Keep your place there in 1 Samuel. And turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 5. Ecclesiastes chapter 5, and beginning with verse 4. And it says, And when thou vowest a vow unto God, defer not to pay it. In other words, you better be sure you pay it. For he has no pleasure in fools. Pay that which thou hast vowed. Verse 5, Better it is that thou shouldest not vow than thou shouldest vow and not pay. And a lot of people think, oh, you know, for someone to vow to God, what a high and noble thing it is. And indeed it can be and should be, if indeed we fulfill our end of the bargain. But how much better, how much nobler, God says, if you're not going to follow through than not to vow at all. Better not to vow than to vow and not follow through. Moses declared the same in Deuteronomy 23 and 21 through 23. He says, "When thou shalt vow a vow unto Yahweh thy God, thou shalt not be slack to pay it. For Yahweh thy God will surely require it of thee." In other words, whether you pay it or not, God's going to make sure he gets his, one way or the other. "And it be no sin in thee, but if thou shalt forbear to vow, it shall be no sin in thee." God doesn't require the vow, but if you vow, he says, you will pay. "That which has gone out of thy lips, thou shalt keep and perform, even a free will offering, according to thou, as thou hast vowed unto Yahweh thy God, which thou hast promised with thy mouth." In other words, God says, you know, not only that which I require of thee, but even that which you come up with on your own, even though I didn't require it of you prior to your vow, once you vowed, I will indeed require it of thee. Numbers 32, Moses also wrote, "If a man vow a vow unto Yahweh or swear an oath to bind his soul with a bond, he shall not break his word. He shall do according to all that proceedeth out of his mouth." Before vowing, let me tell you, it's therefore extremely important that we think it through and that we count the cost that's involved with it. It's easy, you know, it's one thing to be able to say, "Hey, I vow to do it here." And we need to be prepared to say, you know, whatever comes with this vow, I've got to be prepared to fulfill it no matter what. You know, I don't think, for example, that Jephthah had really thought it through completely when he made his vow to God, when he vowed to dedicate to Yahweh whatever it was that first met him upon his return from the victory over the Ammonites. I don't think he'd thought it through. But nevertheless, he certainly held up his end of the bargain, even as it pertained to his daughter, because she was the first thing that met him as he returned home. His vow to Yahweh came first, even over his daughter. And to have done otherwise would have been to have made his daughter more important than Yahweh and to have left her a legacy of spiritual failure. He understood, "I didn't consider this, Lord." And he could have said that. He could have came back and said, "Lord, I thought it would be the dog. I thought it would be a lamb. I thought it would be maybe the oxen at the worst. And I was willing to sacrifice, but not my daughter." And yet he knew that he had vowed and that he must pay what he had vowed unto Yahweh, even as it pertained to his daughter. Joshua understood the significance, the magnitude of keeping his word, keeping covenant even with the Gibeonites, who, if you remember, who had entered into the agreement with Joshua, even with disingenuous motives. If you remember the account, they came with acting as if they'd come from some distance far away and they wanted to be their servants, when in fact they were the neighbors who God had designed to have them killed. Joshua 9, 18 and 19, he says, "And the children of Israel smote them not, because the princes of the congregation had sworn unto them by Yahweh, God of Israel. And all the congregation murmured against the princes. But all the princes said unto the congregation, We have sworn unto them by Yahweh, God of Israel, now therefore we may not touch them." And I think there's something there for us to learn, don't you think? That's how important it was to them, that even when there was disingenuous motives, when there was alternative motives involved, Joshua and the princes understood, "You're not touching them, because we have vowed unto them in the name of Yahweh." Furthermore, Christians need to understand that it makes no difference whether we actually use God's name or not when making a vow or an agreement or a contract with someone. Because as Christians, all that we do, quote, in word or deed, end of quote, is done, quote, in the name of the Lord Yeshua, end of quote, quote, Colossians 3 and verse 17. And therefore, every vow, every agreement, every contract entered into by a Christian is therefore done under the auspices of the third commandment, and should be kept as if it were with Yahweh himself. So what about Hannah? You know, if you hadn't read the story, what do you think, Hannah, what's going to happen now that Hannah's got this son that she so desperately looked for and wanted? Consider her situations. For years, literally years, because we know Penina during all this time has had not only one son and not only one daughter, but it says she's had sons and daughters, indicating that she's had many. So there's been many years that have passed. And for all of these years, Hannah's been barren while her son, while her rival, excuse me, has bore all of these sons and daughters. And Hannah's greatest desire during all of those years was simply to bear a child herself. It was the central, overriding, driving force in her life. Or was it? I don't think so. I don't think that was the overriding force, driving force in her life, demonstrated in her response to Yahweh's response to her agreement with him. But I do think that next to what was the central driving force in her life, that is her dedication to Yahweh, there obviously was nothing more important to her than childbearing. And how easy it could have been, putting yourself in her place, how easy it could have been for her to have just conveniently forgotten, or to have somehow justified in her mind reneging on her side of the agreement with God. How easy sometimes it is for us to do the same, if we're not careful. But not Hannah. And that was because, as important as this child was to her, the fact is that Yahweh was even more important to her. And just as Abraham was willing to sacrifice his Isaac for Yahweh, and note, I didn't say sacrifice his Isaac to Yahweh, but sacrifice his Isaac for Yahweh. And just as Abraham was willing to sacrifice his Isaac for Yahweh, Hannah was willing to sacrifice her little Sammy for Yahweh as well. She was willing to sacrifice him for her relationship with God. First Samuel, back to 1 Samuel chapter 1. Something possibly you've never thought about, but let me ask you this. Why did she name him Samuel? Why did she name him Samuel? Well, I'll tell you why. She didn't like all those other names in the line. Well, I think there was more to it than that. Look at verse 20. We didn't read all of verse 20. Let's read it all now. That's Ecclesiastes. Let me get back there. Hang on. 1 Samuel chapter 1 and verse 20 in its entirety. It says, "Wherefore it came to pass, when the time was come about Let me start that again. Wherefore it came to pass, when the time was come about, after Hannah had conceived, that she bare a son, and called his name Samuel, saying, Because I have asked him of Yahweh." You know, I suspect that although Yahweh was of first importance to her, that even though Yahweh had the preeminent place in her heart, that she nevertheless named him Samuel because she knew as she looked into his baby blue eyes, or whatever they were, of her firstborn and her only son. And as he looked back and cooed her time and again, she knew how difficult it would be for her to do as she had covenanted, to hold up her end of the bargain with Yahweh. And because she knew that she would at times be tempted to try to figure out a way to justify welching on her agreement, I suspect it was for that reason that she named him, "I have asked him of Yahweh." I think that's why she named him that. Because she needed to be reminded, especially during those first, well, all of the months she only had him possibly for 2 years. And how time and again she looked at him and she loved him. And he looked back and he cooed at her and made those gurgling sounds and those other sounds too. And And she thought, I've got to hold true to my covenant with my God. And I have to remember that I asked, he's mine because I asked him of Yahweh. And that she did. Praise Yahweh, she did. 1 Samuel chapter 1, picking it up with verse 21. And the man Elkanah and all his house went up to offer unto Yahweh the yearly sacrifice and his vow. But Hannah went not up, for she... And Hannah went not up, for she said unto her husband, I will not go up until the child be weaned, and then I will bring him, that she may appear before Yahweh and there abide forever. And Elkanah her husband said unto her, Do what seemeth thee good, tarry until thou have weaned him, only Yahweh establish his word. So the woman abode and gave her son suck until she weaned him. And when she had weaned him, she took him up with her, with three bullocks, and one ephah of flour, and a bottle of wine, and brought him unto the house of Yahweh in Shiloh. And the child was young. And they slew a bullock, and brought the child to Eli. And she said, O my Lord, as thy soul liveth, my Lord, I am the woman that stood by thee here, praying unto Yahweh. For this child I prayed, and Yahweh has given me my petition, which I asked of him. Therefore also, I have lent him to Yahweh as long as he liveth, and he shall be lent to Yahweh, and he worshipped Yahweh there. You know, I thought that it said, and she worshipped Yahweh there. Didn't read it closely until again this morning, but it says, and he worshipped Yahweh there. And indeed, Samuel did, as he grew older, worshipped Yahweh there, and he became one of the greatest, most well-known of nearly, if not all, of the priests outside of Aaron, and possibly Phinehas, that he became, because he worshipped Yahweh, he became one of the best-known priests of his day. But so did Hannah. Hannah worshipped Yahweh too, and how she worshipped him, I think, is worthy for us worth our consideration, because she just didn't give Samuel to Yahweh and then declare, there, you have him. Yahweh giveth and Yahweh taketh away. She could have approached it that way, but she didn't. Instead, at that time in her life when she had to have been absolutely beside herself in anguish of spirit and heartache, she rejoiced. And she praised Yahweh with one of the most beautiful prayers recorded in the Bible. Somewhat akin to Habakkuk, if you will, before we go there. Habakkuk 3, 17 through 19, where he wrote and he said, Though the fig tree should not blossom, and though there be no fruit on the vines, though the yield of the olive should fail, and the fields produce no food, though the flock should be cut off from the fold, and there be no cattle in the stalls. You talk about destitute. And he says, Yet I will exult in Yahweh. I will rejoice in the God of my salvation. In spite of all of that, and that indeed is what the Bible describes as a sacrifice of praise. Let's go on with Hannah. 1 Samuel chapter 2. And it says, And Hannah prayed and said, My heart rejoiceth. Here she is. She's given away this thing she's looked for years, maybe 20, 30 years, what she aspired and wanted and desired more than anything else other than to serve God. And here she has to give him away and probably see that child only once every year until the moment she dies, because she had fulfilled her end of the bargain by giving him to God forever. And yet she says, it says, And Hannah prayed and said, My heart rejoices in Yahweh. My horn is exalted in Yahweh. My mouth is enlarged over my enemies because I rejoice in thy salvation. There is none holy as Yahweh, for there is none beside thee, neither is there any rock like our God. Talk no more so exceedingly proudly. Let not thy arrogancy come out of your mouth. For Yahweh is a God of knowledge, and by him actions are weighed. The bows of the mighty men are broken, that stumbled are girded with strength. They that were full have hired out themselves for bread, and they that were hungry ceased, so that the barren has borne seven, and she that has many children is waxed feeble. Yahweh killeth and maketh alive. He bringeth down to the grave and bringeth up. Yahweh maketh poor and maketh rich. He bringeth low and lifteth up. He raises up the poor out of the dust and lifteth up the beggar from the dunghill to set them among princes and to make them inherit the throne of glory. For the pillars of the earth are Yahweh's, and he has set the world upon them. He will keep the feet of his saints, and the wicked shall be silent in darkness. For by strength shall no man prevail. The adversaries of Yahweh shall be broken to pieces out of heaven. Shall he thunder upon them? Yahweh shall judge the ends of the earth, and he shall give strength unto his king and exalt in the he will exalt in the horn of his anointed. What a prayer! And she praised and she rejoiced in the God of her salvation. Notice also, I said that she could have said, and I didn't notice this before, but she could have said, Yahweh giveth and Yahweh taketh away. She almost prayed that. But I want you to notice in the opposite fashion. In verse 6, Yahweh killeth. She starts off with, instead of with the positive and goes to the negative, she starts off with a negative and goes to the positive. She says, Yahweh killeth and maketh alive. He bringeth down to the grave and bringeth up. Yahshua maketh poor and maketh rich. He bringeth low and he lifteth up. Her was a positive prayer of praise and rejoicing in spite of the fact that it had to be one of the lowest points in her life. She still believed in his sovereignty and his grace. A prayer, a song of not despair, but a prayer and a song of victory, because Hannah believed, she trusted, she knew that all things indeed work together for good to those who love God and to those who are called according to his purpose. She understood, and she knew what a mother Hannah was, and one who certainly deserves a place in Yahweh's word. But more importantly for us to understand is that Hannah was the mother she was because of the servant she was to Yahweh. And for that reason, she is truly one of those few women in the annals of history who merits the words, many daughters have done nobly, but thou excellest them all. Favor is deceitful, beauty is vain, but a woman who feareth Yahweh, she shall be praised. Blessed be Hannah. Her legacy lives on both in the Word and in today's mothers. Today's Hannahs are those mothers today who are like Hannah in that same regard. All right, I wanted to start with that. But for the remainder of remainder of this year's Mother's Day message, I want to change gears here some now and to an email that I received just a couple of days ago and maybe lighten things up just a little bit. This email provided, and some of you may have already saw it. I know probably Katie had. But this email provided answers from young children to questions about mothers. And I thought you'd enjoy some of this. Beginning with the question, why did God make mothers? One young child said, she's the only one who knows where the scotch tape is. And it's, I assure you, it's true. And I'm not making this up. It wasn't 2 hours after I received this email. Linda was on the telephone and Jared asked me for some scotch tape. And I didn't have a clue where the scotch tape was. Even after he told me what drawer it was in, I couldn't figure out what drawer he was talking about. Now, I'm not absolutely certain why, of all the reasons why Yahweh made mothers, but I do know why he made wives as helpmeets to us men. That I know, that Yahweh made wives to be helpmeets to us men, which men is just a polite way of saying that we're pretty well inept without them. Another youngster answered the same question, why he thought that God made mothers. He says, to help us out of there when we're getting born. Praise God for mothers. And all the men said, amen. Another question, how did God make mothers? One answered, he used dirt just like all the rest of us. And I'll guarantee you that was a little boy who was trying to figure out some way to get out of baths. Another one answered, magic plus superpowers and lots of stirring. I don't know how he came up with that one, but that's what he said. And another, God made mom just the same like he made me. He just used bigger parts. Why did God give you your mother and not some other mother? Because we're related, one said. Another one, God knew she likes me a whole lot more than other people's moms like me. And you know, I noticed that when I was growing up. My buddy's moms didn't seem to appreciate me anywhere near like my mother appreciated me. That is most of the times. And then there were those other times that even my mom didn't seem to appreciate me near as much, near, or at least all that much. Like the time when my brother threw a four-bladed broadhead in my upper leg. Now, to be fair to my mother, you need to understand that prior to this accident, my brother and I had already pretty much single-handedly paid for the fourth floor of the Poudre Valley Memorial Hospital in Fort Collins, Colorado. For example, earlier the same year, as I was being wheeled into the hospital to have my right eye removed from another bow hunting accident, my brother and I just about passed in the hallway. He was being wheeled out in a body cast from his chest down, all the way down one leg and halfway down the other one. Having tried to beat a truck through an intersection on his bicycle for the second time. Yeah, he got hit twice on his bicycle, not the same day, some years apart. Well, let me tell you, by the time or at the time when Bob stuck me with that broadhead, my poor mom had it. And there was just no sympathy left in her. And when my buddies came into the house dragging me between them with one side of my hip waders half full of blood, her only response was, "Go get in the car." Children, beware. There is a limit to even how much your mothers can take. Another question was asked, what ingredients are mothers made of? And this is probably one of my favorite answers, maybe not necessarily the favorite, but one of my favorite answers out of all of them. This young child responded, he said, God made mothers out of clouds and angel hair and everything nice in the world. And one dab of mean. However, let me point out something, and more so for the fathers than for the mothers. Sometimes some mother's dab of mean isn't sufficient. It's not enough. Now, some, there's no problem with that. But with others, some of them, their dab of mean just isn't sufficient enough. Lord willing, I thought this would be the easiest way for me to share this, but Lord willing, the following will be in the Fifth Commandment booklet when it's published, under a section entitled Mothers First. That although the First Commandment lists fathers before mothers, Leviticus 19:1-3, which mandates that children should fear their parents, reverses that order and specifies mothers first. Let me share Leviticus 19:1-3 with you. It says, and Yahweh spake unto Moses, saying, speak unto all the congregation of the children of Israel, and say unto them, ye shall be holy, for I, Yahweh, your God, am holy. And then in verse 3 it says, you shall fear every man his mother and his father, and keep my Sabbath, I am Yahweh your God. Now, continuing, because the Bible does not expound upon Yahweh's reason for placing mothers first in this particular statute, one can only speculate the reason for this sequence alteration. It is generally true that children have the innate tendency to fear their fathers more than their mothers. With this in mind, mothers were possibly given precedence in this statute to help ensure that they will not be taken advantage of by their children. If wives treat their husbands with honor, respect, and gentleness, they will reap great dividends. However, when it comes to their children, there are times when mothers need to be tough. Some women, because of their very nature, have difficulty doing so. Consequently, husbands must be their wives' first line of defense. If the child's mother does not enforce this biblical statute, the child's father must enforce it on his wife's behalf. In other words, fathers must never, under any circumstances, permit their children to speak or to act dishonorably toward their mothers. End of the quote, or what will be somewhat close to the quote that we have, Lord willing, in the Fifth Commandment booklet. Listen to me, fathers, it's your responsibility, whether you're whether you see your wife as having the dabamine in your wife is sufficient or not, it's still your responsibility to always be their first line of defense between them and their children, and that you do not allow your children to ever treat them disrespectfully. Because again, some, especially with those mothers whose dabamine just isn't hardly there. Another question, what kind of little girl was your mom? My mother has always been my mom and not any of that other stuff. Once again, I guarantee that was little boy's answer. None of that other stuff, not my mom, no sirree. Here's what I'm sure is another little boy's response to the same question. I don't know because I wasn't there, but my guess would be pretty bossy. And another one, they say she used to be nice. Now that one had plenty. The hair dabamine was sufficient, I guarantee you. Another question, how did your mom meet your dad? Mom was working in a store and dad was shoplifting. I'm sure dad really appreciated that one. Another question, why did your mom marry your dad? My dad, one answered, my dad makes the best spaghetti in the world and my mom eats a lot. I'll bet mom didn't appreciate that answer. Now, that was not, I assure you, any of my children's answer to that question. The only thing I can cook is scrambled eggs, and Linda does not eat a lot. In fact, we get concerned that she doesn't eat enough. So it wasn't this. Furthermore, none of my children would say that mine are the best scrambled eggs in Scotts Bluff, let alone in the rest of the world, except for possibly Jared. Bless his heart. One day my children were expounding upon how bad my scrambled eggs are at the dinner table. And Jared, again, bless his heart, when he was just a little guy, he piped up and came to my defense and he said, "That's not true." He said, "Dad's eggs only make me throw up to here," lifting his hand to the top of his chin or the bottom of his chin. I want you to know it's a fact. I confess that Linda did not marry me for my good cooking. She married me for my good looks. Another child answered the same question as to why her mother married her father. And this little child said she got too old to do anything else with him. And another answered, "My grandma says that mom didn't have her thinking cap on." Another question, they were asked, "Who's the boss at your home?" One answered, "Mom, you can tell by room inspection. She sees the stuff under the bed," as only a mom would. And another one answered in this fashion and said, "Mom doesn't want to be the boss, but she has to because dad's such a goofball." Now, the sad fact of that answer is in far too many homes, it's not funny. It's the truth. Don't be looking at me. It's not the case. I may be a goofball, but I'm still the head of my house. But back to being serious. Sad fact of the answer is, again, is that so often it's not funny, and it's in fact the truth. And let me add this, men. The fact is, you're never the head of your home, unless you're the head of your home spiritually. You may be the man of your house, but you're not the head of your home if you're not spiritually the head of your home. Young men, you need to understand that as well. If you're going to be the head of your home and not just the man of your house, you need to be so spiritually, most importantly, above all else. However, if you're spiritually the head of your home, you will have no choice but to be the man of your house, the man of your house, or otherwise you're in disobedience to your spiritual calling, because God has called us to be the man of our house because we're the head of our home. Which leads us right into the next question, or at least one of the answers to it. What's the difference between moms and dads? One answered, "Dads are taller and stronger, but moms have all the power." Because that's who you have to ask if you want to sleep over at one of your friends. Ladies, let me clue you in on something here. Don't answer such questions from your children. Don't take it upon yourself to even answer the most smallest of questions. Don't answer them. Instead, ask your children if they've asked their father, which is just another way to point them to him as their head, and at the same time assist your husbands in taking the lead. And fathers, when your children come to you with such questions, there's nothing wrong, of course, with asking them what their mothers think. But don't shirk your responsibility, even in the smallest of matters, by telling your children to go ask their mother. Be involved in their lives, even in those smallest of areas. And by the way, sleeping over at a friend's is not a small area to begin with. And at any point in their life, their question is never a small matter to them, even if it is to you. Take your place as the head of your family, even in the smallest of matters, because if you won't do it in the smallest of matters, it's unlikely that you'll do it in the bigger matters either. Another young person answered the question, what's the difference between moms and dads? Moms know how to talk to teachers without scaring them. That's a pretty good answer. Another question was, is anything about your mom perfect? Yeah, one said, her teeth. But she bought them from the dentist. But that mother was real excited about that answer, too. Another one said, her casserole recipes. But we all hate them. And another one, just her children. Not my children. Another question. If you could change one thing about your mom, what would it be? Well, one said, she has this weird thing about keeping my room clean. I'd change that. And another one, I'd like my mom smarter. Then she would know it was my sister who did it and not me. And lastly, the last question, describe the world's greatest mom. One answered, she'd be able to make broccoli taste like ice cream. Another one said, the greatest mom in the world wouldn't make me kiss my fat aunts. Aunts, I better say aunts in that one in case it's misunderstood. And another one said, and she'd always be smiling and keep her opinions to herself. But quite the opposite, young person. You need a mother who will not keep her opinions to herself. And especially when you don't want to hear her opinions. Proverbs chapter 1 and verses 8 and 9. My son, hear the instruction of thy father and forsake not the law of thy mother, for they shall be an ornament of grace upon thy head and chains about thy neck. It wasn't any of the former answers to that last question that made Hannah or that makes your mother. By the way, count it a privilege if your mother, if you live in a Christian home, because I couldn't say this if it were otherwise. But it wasn't any of those former answers, or that probably a lot of other answers that children would come up with, that was what made Hannah or that makes your mother one of the greatest mothers of all time. But instead, it's their love and their devotion to Yahweh. Favor is deceitful and beauty is vain. But the woman that feareth Yahweh, she shall be praised. Give her the fruit of her hands, and let her own works praise her in the gates. Her children shall rise up and call her blessed, her husband also, and he praises her. Many daughters have done virtuously, but thou excellest them all. God bless today's mothers, and especially today's Hannahs, who fear and love Yahweh above all else, including their husbands, and yes, even their little Hannahs, their little Samuels and their little Sarahs. The mother, the Hannah today, who puts Yahweh above everything else, knowing that even that, and only that, can make her all that her husband and her children need her to be. Praise God for today's mothers. Let's stand. We'll close in prayer. Heavenly Father, we're thankful, Lord, to you again for this day that helps us to remember how blessed we are to have had a mother. for we wouldn't even be here without them, and especially, Father, if we've had a Hannah in our life who's loved Yahweh above all else, tried to live that example before our children and tried to pass it on to them. Help them to appreciate, help the husbands to appreciate such a woman and to really believe and to praise her, Father, that indeed she is one of those very rare jewels in today's world that excelleth all the rest. I thank you for mine, and I praise you for her, and I thank you, Father, for those who have likewise. We glorify you now and praise you and thank you in Yeshua the Christ. Amen.